I firmly believe that every important point can be made quickly, slowly, and somewhere in between. And pretty much, I think you can fit it for whatever amount of time you have. So I'm going to front load this by telling you what I'm going to be saying. And I'm going to give you a couple of examples. And when we run out of time, I will stop. And if you want to continue, I can very easily email you several hundred pages of additional data. That's with no...
Can you hear that now?
Oh, okay. With no... How's this? How's that? Is that better? Okay. Because essentially what I've been doing for the last 7-8 years is studying two civilizations, one of which is not well known, one of which we thought we knew very well, and the third is the mixture between the two. And the one that we thought we knew was the culture of the Babylonian Talmud, which, let me give you a little statistic, consists of 1,863,000 words. Certainly enough data there for an historian to work with. That of Middle Persian culture, which is much smaller in terms of its corpus of text, but nevertheless is very illuminating. But the comparison between the two tells us a lot more. And to give you an idea of what it is that we can find out, let me give you an example. Let's say 1,500 years from now, somebody, an archaeologist, comes and digs up American Jewry. And he also has information about European Jewry. And he discovers, very strange, that there's this holiday called Hanukkah that suddenly became very important in American Jewry, and in Europe it was no big deal. And as a matter of fact, I can tell you as a first generation American, when I was a kid it was no big deal. You know, and yet suddenly it's become very important. Why? If you don't know the context, you don't understand it. Because internally, you know, Pesach is much more important. Yom HaRoim, the other Shalosh Regalim, and so on. So what all of a sudden, why is Hanukkah important? Obviously, we know why. Because a non-Jewish holiday occurs about the same time. And Jewish parents have to kind of fight the influence of this non-Jewish holiday. And so suddenly, Hanukkah became much more important than it had been before. So in other words, if you don't know the context, you really don't understand what's happening socially and culturally, and sometimes even religiously. And so what's happened to me now is I've had an education into the context, the cultural context of Babylonian Jewry. And why is Babylonian Jewry important? Because they produced the Babylonian Talmud. And the Babylonian Talmud is, I teach Bible also, but I have to admit that when it comes to a formative document, a basic document of Orthodox Judaism, of Rabbinic Judaism, there's no comparison. We know Tanakh through the Bavli. That's where, in a sense, where Tanakh gets its authority. If Chazal don't interpret a verse in a certain way, it's very nice, a nice pshat. We can have a Dvar Torah, all kinds of things. It doesn't really count. Okay. So let me now kind of introduce you to a Babylonian Jewry that you may not be aware of. As a matter of fact, I'm sure you're not aware of. And so let me start out, and by the way, let me apologize. If I had known the kind of lighting we would have, I would have used a larger font size. But I didn't know that, so I will read, and you'll have this, when you go home, if you're interested, you can read it yourselves. If you're really interested, I can send you a 52-page version of this handout. I'm serious. Anyway, there's a very interesting Gemara at the end of Menachos, almost at the very end, where Rav Huna says, he interprets a verse in Isaiah, and he says, "Havi bonai merechok v'nosam ikseh oretz, bring my sons from afar and my daughters from the ends of the earth." Said Rav Huna, what does this verse refer to? "Elu galil shel bavel, shedatun v'yusheves aleim kivanim." These are the exiles, the people who lived in Babylonia, whose minds are at ease as sons' minds are at ease, and the others, meaning the other exiles of Vnosim, Mitzeres, who are compared to daughters, are the other Galias, like the Jews who lived in the Roman Empire, and their minds are not at ease. 2 points. First of all, Clearly, we're talking about a situation in which the Jews in the Roman Empire were persecuted. We're talking about a time when Christianity was well on its way to becoming the official religion of the Roman Empire. It wasn't quite there yet, but it was getting there. And they were no longer, and certainly even before that, they didn't have a great time with the Roman pagans. Masha Ein Kein, if you compare the situation in Sasanian Babylonia, and let me just tell you something about Sasanian Babylonia. The Sasanian dynasty came into power in the year 224 CE, just at the beginning of the Amoraic period. They continued into the Arab conquest, which for Iraq meant 638 CE. The entire Amoraic period, plus they were under Sasanian rule. But more than that, because when did Persian rule begin? Persian rule began in 539 BCE, when Cyrus the Great entered Babylon, the city of Babylon. So the Jews lived under Persian rule for 1,200 years. It's a long time. And except for the story of the Megillah, pretty much they didn't have much trouble. And Rav Huna says their minds were at ease. They felt at home. And as a matter of fact, we'll have a chance probably to introduce you to one pun. The Bavli is full of Middle Persian puns. If you don't understand Middle Persian, you don't get the pun, obviously, and you lose something of the point of the Gemara. They spoke. Again, I don't have the time to go. I can prove everything I'm saying. You're going to have to trust me for the meantime because I don't have that much time. They spoke Middle Persian, at least in the cities, and certainly the rabbis, of whom we know most, the way we speak English. They were aware of Middle Persian literature, as we will see, of culture and even religion, and they involved themselves not with the Christians, interesting enough, but with other sects. They were involved in dialogue, if you will. Anyway, let's continue. So, first of all, sons and daughters, the other end of the metaphor. We're talking about a social institution. A son gets married, who moves where? At this point in history, it's the daughter, the bride, who moves in with the son's family. And she's under her mother-in-law's thumb. And if you want to know what that means, take a look in Yevamos 117a, and you will see how the Gemara estimates who hates whom the most. Okay? Gemara is very straight on. There's no apologetic. They tell you the way it is because they have to decide halacha on that basis. So they're not going to kid themselves. At any rate, so what are we talking about? Sons who are at ease because they remain at home. They're the favored, I think I've lost, no, no. They're the favored offspring. The daughters have to go, and if you've ever read Pearl Buck, in Chinese families, what happens with a daughter-in-law who has to serve the mother-in-law, et cetera, et cetera. It's not happy. Her mind is not at ease. Okay. So he says that the Jews were at ease. After all, at his time, they had already coexisted with the Persians for 800 years. And the Persians were not necessarily tzaddikim, but they had a very good reason to treat the Jews nicely. The Jews were an important 1 to 2 million people in a very important province, not just a very important province, the most important province in the Persian Empire, the Sasanian Empire at that time, Babylonia, Iraq. That was the breadbasket of the empire. It's only after the Arabs took over, the agriculture declined. But during this period, during the Sasanian rule, agriculture in Iraq was more productive than it ever was in history before and certainly after. So it was the breadbasket of the empire. If you know anything about Iran, you know that Iran mostly is an arid plateau. Agriculture is basically in the southwest. And Tehran, if you've ever thought about it, is not in the middle of the country. It's way up in the north near the Caspian Sea because any further down south, there's no place for a large city. There's no water supply, et cetera, et cetera. So as I said, Iraq was a very important province. And, unfortunately, it was also open to Roman invasion. So you wanted the Jews to be happy. And so you kept them happy. And so, therefore, they felt happy. They were at ease because they knew nobody was going to chepa with them. Nobody was going to bother them. And that's what Rav Huna is testifying to. Now, the result of 800 years of being at ease, and which continued, is obviously you adopt the culture of the country. Why not? There's no threat to you, especially since when you consider what was the state religion of the Persian Empire, actually, from the beginning, the Iranian Empire, from the beginning till the end. Anybody know? Excuse me? That's not fair. Okay, Zoroastrianism. He read some of my stuff. Zoroastrianism, in case you don't know, which I assume you don't, since you didn't even know the name, is in a religion that posits two forces in the world, a force for good and a force for evil. We're fighting the evil, but the force for good is a spirit who created the world, who's benevolent, is omnipotent and omniscient, and he's made a bet with a deal with the other spirit. They're going to fight for 9,000 years, at which point the other spirit doesn't know he's going to be destroyed. In the meantime, they have mitzvahs and averus. At the end of your life, they total up the two. If you want over on the plus column, you get the Gan Eden. If you want under on the negative column, you get the Gehenna. After that, though, you're punished. And at the end of time, a kind of messiah-like figure comes, destroys evil. He's the third son of Zoroaster. After which, everybody is resurrected. Sounds familiar, doesn't it? Sounds comfortable. Especially now, you could say Christianity has the same idea. One basic difference. Christianity claims to supersede Judaism. Zoroastrianism doesn't make such a claim. So you don't have to worry about them. They want you to be happy. You want to be happy. Everybody's happy. It's wonderful. Okay. It's not just the Jews. You had a multi-ethnic empire, a multi-religious empire. And if you'll take a look on the first page in the middle, we have a Zoroastrian high priest who left us several copies of a large inscription on the side of a mountain, side of mountains, I should say. And he says as follows, "And from province to province, place to place throughout the empire," if you hear the style of the Book of Esther, it's not an accident. "The rites of Ormazd and the gods became more important than the Mazdeastian religion, and the Magians," in other words, their religion, "the priests were greatly honored of the empire, and great satisfaction befell the gods," meaning the angels and water and fire and the beneficent creatures, etc., etc. And then he says, "and Jews and Buddhists and Hindus," because the Iranian empire extended to India, "and Nazarenes and Christians and Baptists," various sects of Christians, "and Manichaeans were smitten in the empire, and the idols were destroyed, and the abodes of the demons were disrupted and made into thrones and seats of guards." Now, why do I mention this? I mention this because this is how I got into the whole thing. In a series of papers in the 90s, I pointed out that the Bavli is very different than the Yerushalmi in many respects, but one in particular. The Bavli is much more open to the question of Tzadik v'Rolo, why the righteous suffer, theodicy. And the Yerushalmi kind of dodges the issue. And I presented this once at an Orthodox forum, and one of Yossi Blau's sons, Yitzi, asked me, I should say one other thing, and that is I showed in a series of articles that Rava is the reason that the Bavli is different. His influence on the Bavli is tremendous, and he dealt with this. So Yitzi asked, why Rava Bedafka? And I didn't have a ready answer. I fumfed, if you know the Yiddish word. I kind of said, if you think was there a Holocaust at that time, there wasn't. Jews had it good, as you see. People differ in their sensitivity to this question. Nonsense. People are very sensitive to this question, especially at that time they were. The difference was that I was ignoring the 800-pound gorilla in the room, which is the Zoroastrian religion. Rava was responding to the challenge of Zoroastrianism, which seems to provide a very easy answer to the question of theodicy. Why do the righteous suffer? Because the evil spirit makes them suffer. Why don't they? Because the good spirit. It said, isn't that easy? I know Jews to this day in Cambridge, not in New York, who think this is a great religion. Let me give you two examples of this kind of, as a matter of fact, maybe I'll reverse them, since I want to make sure not to run over time. So instead of doing the first, let's take a look at the second, which starts out on the bottom of page 2. I pointed out, in a paper published in around 1990, that Rava has a statement that he makes in Moed Katan 28a, which is rather strange. So if you take a look at page 3, he says, length of life, bane chayim is on a length of life, children who survive you, and sustenance, making a living, all depend not on merit, not on schus, but on mazel. Okay, in other words, you could be, as he continues to explain, and you can read it, so I won't read it for you, you could be an absolutely righteous person and not make a living, have many bereavements, you lose children, you don't live a long life, you live a short life, and you're still an absolutely righteous person. It's not a matter of schus. It's a matter of mazel. On the other hand, you'll be a righteous person, all these things will happen to you, but again, it's not schus, it's mazel, as he gives an example. What that means, among other things, mazel presumably means something like astrology, astrological conjunction, the star under which you're born, etc., etc. This goes against the majority opinion in Shas, the end of Shabbos, Kuf Nun Vov, where, you know, almost all the Amoraim, and actually all the Amoraim of Bavel who talk about it, say, ein mazel liyisrael. The Jews are not influenced by astrology. It's only one Amora in Eretz Yisrael, Rabbi Yosef Reb Chanina, who differs. Rava is going against the received opinion of the Babylonian Amoraim. I pointed that out. What I didn't know, I discovered when I came to Harvard and started studying. Well, I didn't start. I had kind of picked up Middle Persian before that, and you know, I was working with Irenists, as I continue to do. And I discovered that this is actually a very common theme in Middle Persian literature. It appears all over the place, really very, very often. Rava is quoting a very common saying in Middle Persian, a saying with religious dimensions. So take a look. I just gave you one example. I could multiply this. You could have a 6-page handout just with this. The answer is thus. The sages had, that's in the middle of page 3, the sages have said thus. The sages have said that there are some things through allotment, through fate, in other words, and some things through deeds, meaning mitzvahs. They have judged as follows. Being born, wife, meaning who you're going to marry, who's by sheret, child, authority, and property, meaning sustenance, parnasa, are through allotment, fate. And the priesthood, warriorhood, husbandry, meaning being a farmer, which for them was an inyan. Righteousness and wickedness are through deeds. Okay, now, so 3 of these 5, I don't have the time, but 5 is a big number in Zoroastrian and Manichaean theology. But at any rate, 3 of them, being born, child, and property, are the 3 that Rava chooses. There are the other 2. The other 2 also appear in the Bavli. Take a look a little further down. The beginning of Sota, Rav says, you all know, Abraham Yom Kodem Yitzhiras Avlad, Machriz Meneshmayim, Bas Ploni, Ploni, etc., Bas Ploni, Ploni, Stay Ploni, Ploni. In other words, 40 days before the embryo is created, there is an announcement from heaven that so-and-so, you know, his daughter is going to be married to so-and-so, so-and-so's house is going to be sold to so-and-so, so-and-so's field is going to be sold to so-and-so. So he's got 3 also. 3, of course, for us is as important as 5 is for them. And you have to add wife. So 4 of these 5 elements are already in the Bavli, and as a matter of fact, as we'll see, if you go to the bottom of the page, the 5th element is there also. Amar Rav Chanan bar Rav, Amar Rabbi Yochanan, afilu resh gargita min shemayim anolei. Even a canal inspector is appointed by heaven. That's the 5th element. Okay, what's interesting is, if you take a look, and this is what anybody who learns should take a look at this, Rava is the great-grandson-in-law of Rav. Rav Chanan bar Rava is the son-in-law of Rav. Rav Chista is his son-in-law, and of course Rava is Rav Chista's son-in-law. So in other words, all parts of this saying go down, are transmitted through one prominent rabbinic family. Okay? In other words, here's a case where Rava had, and I don't have the time to go into this, but Rava lived in what I call West Side Mechoza. Mechoza was a suburb of the Persian capital. And was open to all kinds of cosmopolitan influences. And Rava had to deal with that, meaning he had to deal with West Side Mechoza. And he did. We have a good deal of evidence for this. And this is part of what he did. Now, does that mean he was lechatchila Torah Madaju? He was in that situation. Did he prefer it? I'm not sure if he preferred it. I don't know that it even occurred to him, because remember, we're talking about over 800 years of coexistence. It didn't, you know, what's the point of saying, ooh, you know, 800 years, if this was 800 years ago, you know, there's no point. So at any rate, he dealt with the problems that he dealt with. I told three Rashi Yeshiva YU about it. Two of them were absolutely, you know, I said, really, this is, you know, this really sounds contemporary. You know, you should go public with this. And I have. Now, how are we fixed with time? Okay, we have a little time. Let's take a look at another very interesting Gemara. Now you'll learn a little Middle Persian, because this is based on a pun. The bottom of page one. The Gemara is talking about Sifrei Kodesh, Tanachs, that are in a Bei Abidan. A Bei Abidan is like an annex to a Zoroastrian temple. There's an interesting Taisus, which I've reproduced from Avodah Zohar about this, Machlokes Taisus, Rashi and Taisus, but it's probably not a base of Avodah Zohar, as Taisus points out. And the question is, what do you do with them in case there's a fire? Do you save them or not? Is there any Kedusha there? And so they asked Rav Avoh, and he said, sometimes he said yes, sometimes he said no, he wasn't sure. Now, then they have a very interesting port. Rav lo ozel Bei Abidan. So Rav would not go to Bei Abidan to debate. V'chol shekein lebein nitzrafein, not to a Christian annex. Nobody would go there, by the way. Absolutely nobody would debate with the Christians. Because as the Gemara says, the Christians knew, they recognized their Creator and rejected Him. With them, we're not going to have any discussions. Shmuel lebein nitzrafein lo ozel, he wouldn't go to debate with the Christians, but he went to the Bei Abidan. And I won't go into the next, because that will take a whole discussion. But then it says that Mar Bar Yosef, which is probably Rav Yosef, which you have in Ksaviyat Minchin, he says, I'm from them, I'm not afraid of them. Zimna chad ozul ba'ul l'sakone. Once he went and they wanted to harm him. The question is, why do they want to harm him? I think the answer is in Megillah, turn the page. There's a very interesting, really difficult saying in the middle of page 2 about Rav Yosef about the Persians. And he asked the question why the symbol of Persia in the book of Daniel chapter 7 is a bear, a dove. And he says as follows, this refers to the Parseim, she'ochlin v'shosin kedov, they eat and drink like bears. As a matter of fact, the Bavli itself says they're very abstemious. So it's a question of, you know, like, are they, what does that mean? Mr. Bodim Basar Kedov, they're actually fat like bears, because if you eat and drink like bears, you look like a bear. That's the bear truth. Umagadin Sayer Kedov, I'm shameless. If that's available, I will do it. Okay. Anyway, and they grow their hairs like bears. Vein lehem menuch Kedov, and they have no rest like bears. Now, bears hibernate. You know, so what's going on here? It's all based on a pun. The pun is the Hebrew word dove bear, and the Persian word dev, which means a demon. And the demons are the armies of the evil spirit. Now, the Zoroastrian confession of faith, which is repeated 5 times during the day, they daven 5 times a day. That's where the Arabs got it, by the way. At any rate, is that it goes like this. I belong to the good spirit. I do not belong to the bad spirit. I am a member of the anti-demon religion. And in interreligious controversies, they accuse the Jews of being a demonic religion. Okay? So what is he saying? He's saying, not only are you not a member of the anti-demonic religion, you yourselves are demons. Now, let's work this out. Demons eat and drink. We know that from Chagiga. That's Zion. Okay? We know that from other sources as well, but the Gemara accepts that. And of course, if you eat and drink, you do get fat. Look at me. Then, Umagadin Serikdov is particularly interesting. I'm sorry I didn't bring, I have some Sasanian coins at home. But there are pictures of Sasanian kings. We know what Shabar the First, Shvar Malka, both of them, we know what they look like from their coins. What they have, among other things, is very carefully kind of, you know, hair in a sphere behind their necks. The idea is that if you even lose one piece, one hair that falls on the ground, it becomes a weapon in the hands of the demons. So they're very careful about the hair. To this day, by the way, they wear hairnets. But at any rate, so therefore their enemies, the Arabs later on, the Turks later on, were called Devan Vizadvars, demons with disheveled hair. So when he says Magatan Sayakadov, means they are demons with disheveled hair. Okay? He's actually insulted them in the way that they insult their enemies. So he really knows the literature, he knows the religion, he knows how to get at them. He really knows, if you know the word shtach, he knows how to, you know, really give it to them. Naturally, they wanted to harm him. And the Ein Lemenucha Kedov, we know again from the same Gemara in Chagiga that demons, Mazikim, go, you know, all around, you know, flit around the world. So in other words, here you have, it happens to be rather interesting and important, but I don't have the time to go into it. Rava comes from a cosmopolitan community. Rav Yosef does not come. Pumbedisa is as far from the capital as you can get and still be in Jewish Babylonia, and it's an insular community. I used to think of it as Williamsburg until I discovered there were no Haredim in Jewish Babylonia. Absolutely, 800 years is no Haredim. So even in Pumbedisa, where they didn't have as much use for Goyim as they had in Mechoza, they still, you know, we knew what was going on. At any rate, they were all aware of the general culture. They all interacted with the general culture. They used the language and they used the culture. And as far, at this point, meaning after 8 years of looking at this, I have to say I don't find anybody who rejected the idea of looking at the general culture, being part of the general culture, etc., interacting with it. What do I mean? I mean very simply, there are no ghettoized Jews, as far as I can tell, in 1.8 million words in the Bavli in Jewish Babylonia. Modern Orthodoxy, or Torah Mada, or centrist Orthodoxy, whatever you call it, is not a Dei Eved, it's Lachatchila. We have it in the Gemara. You don't have to go to the Rambam. It's way back before the Rambam. One last thing, which is actually probably the most difficult. Take a look at page 4. I will be on time. There's a story that Rav Ashi heard probably from the Reish Galusa, the head of the Jewish community, the Exilarch, who represented the Jewish community before the Sasanian King of Kings. So he was once standing before Yazdegerd, probably the first, and his belt slipped up, whereupon he pulled it down, observing to me, "It is written of you, a king of priests and holy nation." By the way, in Persian history, Yazdegerd the first is called the wicked. He had a Christian mother, and he actually was good to the Christians and to the Jews. This might explain how he could quote a pasuk in Shmos. But you'll notice he talks about the kingdom of priests and holy nation. What's going on here is, if you take a look at the last marker, the bottom page 4, one of the differences in minhag between the Jews of Babylonia and the Jews of Eretz Yisrael was that the Jews of Babylonia wore belts. Now, again, you have to know the context. You know, they wore gartlach, you know. Why? Because that was the custom. But there was a religious dimension to the custom. There are two symbols of identification with Zoroastrianism to this day that Zoroastrians wear. One is a kustik, which is a belt, and the other is a sudra, which is an undershirt kind of thing. I met a Zoroastrian student of mine in Cambridge. He was just about getting ready for his orals. I said, "Johann, do you have your sudra and kustik?" "Of course. You know, I wouldn't go to my orals without it." Comprehensive, anyway. Okay, so anyway, it went from top to bottom. It went from rabbis to laymen, from men to women. Everybody was affected by the fact that they had spent, eventually, 1,200 years under relatively benign, in the end it wasn't so benign. We can go into that some other time. But certainly in the middle of the 4th century, time of Rava, they had it pretty good. And once the Jews have it pretty good, then they start looking around, looking for Eitzes. By the way, they had it so good they could cheat on their taxes. I can prove that. Okay. That's how comfortable they felt. You know, you got to feel pretty comfortable to cheat on your taxes. You also have to know the tax system pretty well to be able to cheat on your taxes. So that's basically, that is a point I want to make, and that's what I'll stop with. In other words, don't think, and this is really the point I'm here to make, don't think that the lifestyle that we have adopted is some kind of a compromise, and that, you know, we're not authentic because they're authentic because they dress like 16th century Polish noblemen. We are Jews in the form of Rava and Rav Nachman and Abaya and Rav and Shmuel. I'm mentioning, and Rav Papa, mentioning people I can be sure of. I'm not mentioning Abaya and I'm not mentioning Rava. I'm not sure about them. But the ones I mentioned, I think that's Rov Binyan already. They were, if you will, you know, you have to be careful when you make these historical analogies, but they were kind of, certainly, you know, I like Torah Mada better than modern Orthodox in this case. They were certainly Torah Mada Jews. They were interested and they were aware of, and they knew how to deal with the Mada of their time. And that's basically the point I wanted to make. Thank you very much.